I'm Mark Laberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. Welcome to Conversing. I'm delighted today to welcome Dr. Pamela Epstein King, a professor at Fuller, to be my conversation partner. And I'm delighted to say that she arrived at Fuller on the faculty in 2008. And in 2014, she was named the Peter L. Benson Associate Professor of Applied Developmental Science. She currently works as, in addition to that role, as a key person within what we call the Thrive Center for Human Development at Fuller. All of these things are things that we're going to unpack, and I'm just really, really delighted to have you as a guest today.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
So let's step back before you came to Fuller. You have an interesting story of how you arrived, even at one stage, coming to seminary, not thinking you were going to pursue psychology. You end up pursuing psychology. You end up not only pursuing it, but getting eventually a doctorate in it. You end up coming back and teaching on the psych faculty. So give people a little bit of a teaser of how that narrative unfolded for you.
Sure. As an undergrad at Stanford, I was very interested in business, technology, and values, and how technology and science were actually shaping America's values. I ended up not being able to pursue that at Stanford and ended up, by default, ending up with a degree in psychology. It was 1990, which was the biggest recession that I knew in my lifetime at that point, and thought, I'll go work for the church with kids until there's more jobs, and ended up at Menlo Park Press for 4 very precarious years, but wonderful years. And while I was there as an intern, which was not a very financially lucrative, fruitful.
Sort of experience, yes.
But I could take these things called Fuller classes for free. So I, of Scottish origin, took 3 Fuller courses a year and really enjoyed them. And before I knew it, I had finished a year of a Master's of Divinity. I had also been talked into going into the ordination process, so was doing that as well. And by the time that was all said and done, I really felt a call to go to seminary and finish this Master's of Divinity and pursue ordination, which is not anything I ever anticipated in my life. Although faith had always been a very important and central part of who I was. So I came to Fuller. My husband was interested in acting, so LA seemed like a good place to go. And as I was finishing my MDiv and taking Greek and Hebrew, I started taking electives in the School of Psychology. And upon graduation, the dean then called me into his office in the School of Psychology and said, I just wanted to meet you because you've taken 7 classes in my school, but you're not actually in a degree program. And if you want to take any more, you need to apply for a degree. So I said, well, what degrees you got? And so then I applied for a PhD in marital and family studies and completed that. And before I knew it, I had a PhD in marriage and family studies. I ended up going back to Stanford and doing a postdoc for 2 years in the Center on Adolescence, where I looked at how religion and spirituality and faith served as a resource for young people and promoted positive development. Mm. Positive psychology in 2000 was just beginning to take off. There was not a lot of clarity, but I was really interested in understanding what can go right with kids, not just focusing on what goes wrong with kids, and how I had an instinct that faith was an important part of that. But there was not much science to support that then.
Right. And a lot of your own work has really been actually trailblazing work, not just your own work, but your own work in collaboration with others to try to help create this pathway for looking at the role of spiritual and religious development in adolescence, among others. But that's been a big piece of what you've been working on.
Absolutely. So yeah, my empirical work, the research is really focused on youth, but the concepts theoretically are probably applied throughout the lifespan.
Right.
But yeah, so I think not ever intending to be an academic, I didn't have a lot on the line in terms of identity. So I really didn't think twice about studying something that was absolutely unpopular and known to be like a career killer. And so I started asking questions about religion and spirituality. And it just so happened, Bill Damon, who is still the director of the Center on Adolescence at Stanford, had recently finished a study on moral moral exemplars with his wife, Ann Colby. And one of their findings was that these morally exemplar humans often had faith as a part of their story. But at that point, psychology really had no ways of making sense of that because it was such an understudied topic. So when we crossed paths, he was very intrigued by the questions I was asking and some of the methods that I was using to pursue them. And so he invited me to do the postdoc at Stanford and was able to pursue those questions.
When you heard that research that he had been doing and that there was this perhaps surprising awareness that moral exemplars were people who had been shaped by faith, did that resonate with your own experience and background, or did that sort of surprise you, or how did you receive that?
Yeah. No, absolutely. That was very consonant with my own experience. And then when I was on staff at Menlo, I worked in the high school ministry there for 2 years, which as a large church had about 500 kids. So it was a lot of kids. And also then was the director of the university ministry for 2 years. And I really observed and experienced how young people at this very precarious developmental juncture of life known as adolescence, who had faith, had resources that I saw other kids did not have. So even though, you know, Menlo is a rather privileged, generally socioeconomic status, even more so these days, but kids going through hardships, whether it was divorce or broken families, feeling disconnected, that there were resources that guided them through difficulties and also seemed, especially at the university level, seemed to fuel their sense of person and calling in this world that I didn't see a lot of other young people have.
What was it that you would have said you believed might be the connection between spirituality and moral exemplary living, and what you understood then and what you understand now? What have been some of the shifts that have perhaps the assumptions that you had then that you no longer hold, or surprises that have been confirmed maybe?
Okay, this is a good one. I mean, that's a great question. So I have a flashback to my sophomore year in college when I was taking a class on Carl Jung and writing out on probably some like thought matrix paper about the importance of people having values. And I mentioned at the beginning that I really wanted to study at Stanford. They had a major that was called Values, Technology, Science, and Society. And I had this inclination that people who know what they value and what matters to them will be able to orient their life and organize their life in a coherent way around that. And so I think at that time in my life, that was, I would now say, at a very cognitive level, like knowing what you think is important. What I didn't appreciate that I feel like psychology has given me a lens for is actually the emotional aspect of that. Mm-hmm. So we all know people can know the Ten Commandments or know what's right and wrong, but whether they actually live a life devoted to that and in which those values are manifested in actual actions is a whole different thing. And so that's where issues of transcendence, feeling connected and aware of a God of love that's bigger than oneself or whatever one's perception of transcendence is, can really instigate a sense of devotion and commitment and sustain moral action. And I think that's what was happening in those moral exemplary lives. Because we all know when we're committed to goals, we get obstacles and we need something that will fuel us through those obstacles and challenges.
And is that partly then how emotion figures into that paradigm?
I think for me, it's one of the ways. I mean, I always leave room for supernatural, the work of the spirit. But I think at a very human level, we can understand an experience of love, an experience of belonging. Mm-hmm. And we know from brain science that when we feel safe and secure and known and loved, our brain actually is more flexible and open. And we can take in more, we're more emotionally regulated. We can connect more with people. We can be more vulnerable. And it paves the way for transformation and growth.
One of the things that I think is so significant about all of this is that because for those who are listening in, many of them would no doubt know that a lot of psychology does feel as though its history has been focused a great deal on pathology. And so what's meant by positive psychology, which perhaps we could have you define in just a minute, positive psychology is really in part, as I understand it, a study of the things that actually contribute to healthy well-being and what are the things that actually help that to manifest itself. So what's happening in this study, I'm just sort of reflecting this back to you, what's happening in this process then is that you're trying to look at what are the things that have really truly enabled the best examples to unfold. What were the ingredients of their emotional, mental, cognitive, relational, professional being that ultimately ended up creating a person that we would now call, let's say, an exemplar. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of the telos. We'll come back to that word in a minute. I know it's one of your important words. The telos, the outcome mm-hmm. of a life of well-being. Mm-hmm. Talk about how those things connect.
I think from that study of the moral exemplars, which is in a beautiful book called Some Do Care, things that resonated with me or started provoking my curiosity was that these exemplars had pretty clear convictions about what they believed and how they made sense of the world. However, they held onto them with a posture of humility and openness. So they were not rigid people. They were devout to them, but they were able to be flexible. They were also people who were able to be responsive to the needs of the time in the situation that they were in. And something that was a negative aspect of them that I've held on to is that they weren't always balanced people. So as I started to walk into help create a field of thriving, a question that came with me is, how do people thrive, especially in exemplary ways, without sacrificing other parts of their life? So a lot of the moral exemplars would not necessarily have been recognized as great parents or marital spouses because their lives were so committed to these acts of justice or compassion or service. So that's just a reality of being human. Mm-hmm. We can't do everything all the time.
Right, right. So when you're an emerging psychologist and you begin to catch wind of this significant positive psychology movement that's mm-hmm. beginning to mm-hmm. unfold and you're mm-hmm. seeing these exemplars, mm-hmm. what is it that's triggering your thoughts that ultimately lead then to the establishment at Fuller, at least, of mm-hmm. this, mm-hmm. of the Thrive Center mm-hmm. for Human Development?
Well, really early on, I ended up writing a theoretical paper on religion and identity and how religion may be helpful for young people developing a positive sense of identity. And that opportunity really thrust me into using psychological theories and tools to slice and dice what happens in a religious context. So early on, I started identifying that, wow, within religious contexts, synagogues, mosques, congregations, people have access to beliefs and values. They have a meta-narrative to make sense of life. And in our current culture, even more so now than 20 years ago, there are no very comprehensive meta-narratives. People are really raised skeptical of traditional and conventional narratives, and they're grown in small isolated pockets where there is no story that they can make sense of their whole mm-hmm, life with.
Right.
So that was a great resource. Then also, religious communities provide a social context that's so rich. They have opportunities of people who should, in an ideal world, exemplify these beliefs and values, and they have opportunities to serve and lead. They have things we call social support. And so these rich, they have access to social capital, lots of good relational things. And then lastly, and very unique to faith communities, unlike sports teams and perhaps even scouting or political organizations, would be what I call transcendence. And so young people developing have the opportunity to understand themselves in light of something much bigger than themselves.
So it's not just a human good. It actually is also a human good that has an extension into a transcendent good.
Exactly, right. Exactly. Right. And being raised as whether you're Jewish and part of the covenant people of God or God's chosen or beloved daughter or son of God can actually be quite empowering for people and a great source of hope and motivation.
Right, right. And that's what ultimately brings you to realize how significant telos is, both as a human and ultimately as a spiritual thing.
Yes.
So why don't you explain what telos is and then how it figures into your work? Because it's such an important part of your whole approach.
Definitely. So in my pursuit and desire to understand what it means for diverse persons to thrive, I have thought both psychologically around that and then thought, well, gosh, thriving is really optimal development. It's positive development. And who gets to define what's positive? So in that, I've turned to my theology to say, what would a Christian perspective or my best understanding of God's perspective of human thriving being? And so when I turn to theology and think about telos or purpose or God's goal or hope for humans or what a completed human is, those are all the Greek meanings for telos. I think theologically about that and have thought long and hard about our doctrine of the image of God. And as Christians, we believe that Christ is the perfect image of God. And so humans becoming more like Christ has something to do with our thriving. And we often use the biblical language of being conformed to the image of God in Christ. And one of my understandings of telos is conformity and uniformity are not the same. And so we're not all called to be like Christ as the same person. And if we think about a more Trinitarian perspective of the Imago Dei and think about the three persons of the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, our tradition emphasizes the importance of those, the uniqueness of each, as well as the relationality of them all. And so I then emphasize that part of telos is becoming the unique person that God created us to be. And in psychology, we have a lot of tools for doing that. What is our identity? What are our passions, our purposes, our competencies, our skills? And how do we grow more fully into being our unique self and leaning into our strengths?
I've often thought of that as we mature in Christ, we should become increasingly like one another in our character, but we should be ever more free to be the distinct and unique differentiated people that we are, whereas sociology tries to create a homogeneity of that that is not actually the character of the kingdom.
Absolutely. I mean, I really believe that God delights in our uniqueness and that God broke the mold with each one of us. And that I think the Christian tradition or various aspects of it has gone through seasons of affirming that uniqueness and celebrating that and other seasons of really forcing us into conformity, as you were talking about. But that differentiation and distinctiveness is, I really believe, what God hopes for us.
And this is one of the places where I think positive psychology in some school systems, for example, has been both used and felt abused or been abusive even. So let me see how you interact with this. Some of the effects of positive psychology in educational systems has been to affirm the uniqueness and value of each person's own life, individuality, well-being, et cetera. And it becomes that sort of you are all you have ever meant to be kind of affirmation, right? Which then feels like it does two problematic things. It does something that's in its inherent value really true, but then as a totalizing picture ends up creating a problem as though I am the perfect person in the world all the time in every way. And if you don't get that, it's really your problem. Right. It's never my problem.
Right.
And then it also creates an intense self-identity rather than a kind of communal identity. So how would you think, how does thriving, how does a healthier vision of thriving, A, not kind of create this blanket indemnification that everything that I am is simply everything that God thinks is the best in the world?
Right.
And then how do I also understand my uniqueness in a context of a community?
Right. Like unbridled individualism
is not the telos.
So then going back to even that Trinitarian understanding of the unity of the Godhead, that somehow relationality and unity is part of our design as humans. And we now have a very robust science of how important relationality is and being connected. And so my understanding of thriving rests on not just enabling individuals to become their best selves or to become more fully themselves, but to do that in reciprocating mutual relationships, growing intimacy with those close to them, and making meaningful contributions to the world around them. So thriving does not necessarily mean success. Thriving often involves self-sacrifice and giving, and it has a very strong ethical component because it necessitates the ethics and the morals that bind us in life-giving ways, or maybe connect us in life-giving ways to the world around us. That's central to thriving.
Right. So this is what you mean in a book that you've written called The Reciprocating Self, Human Development in Theological Perspective. I love that title, and I love Ray Turner's paintings, which are on the cover of that book. And I just wonder if you could unpack that just a little more. So the reciprocating self is the self that emerges out of the kind of communal interaction that you're describing.
Exactly. So often in American or Western psychology, autonomy is the goal, and independence. And often interdependence or even attachment is viewed as a means to this end of independence and autonomy. So when I was coming of age psychologically as a graduate student here, I wrote a paper called The Reciprocating Self in response to this kind of unmitigated individualism. And actually, without going on a tangent, around like the American psychotherapeutic movement, which is often a one way the therapist gives to the client.
Right.
And I thought a better telos of a therapeutic relationship is actually to encourage a reciprocating self, not just an individuated, isolated self, but a self that has growing capacities for interconnectedness, a moral sensibility that would sustain contributing to relationships around you. And we know humans develop in relationship. but we never stop this side of.
And which involves giving and receiving. It involves humility as well as self-identity and valuation. It's every dimension.
Every dimension. And humility is so central and I think so necessary in our current context, in which we all do have very different belief systems, whether they're clear or not, or ideals of what is good or successful or thriving or flourishing, because they'll always compete. So my telos, my best understanding of telos might compete with yours, but we have to have the humility to know that we might not all have the best answer and that there has to be give and take from our ideals to coexist and to enable more communal flourishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the things that I think is so radical, really, about what you're doing, because in so much of our culture, there is, not least stoked by advertising in 100,000 forms every single day that encounters our eyeballs or our ears or whatever, that basically says we should be on the quest of our own personal thriving, mm-hmm. and that the mm-hmm. goal is really that I have mm-hmm. experience, mm-hmm. taste, see, hold, own all of these things that are going to mm-hmm. actually fulfill my sense mm-hmm. of myself, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then along comes something that sounds like mm-hmm. it could be on that same note, mm-hmm. and some elements of positive psychology, I think, do. Perhaps they're not fairly understood, but I think they end up at least contributing to that kind
Absolutely.
Of cultural language. Mm-hmm. So let's just imagine that there's listening here, parents who have teenage children who live in a context where their life is a lot about themselves already mm-hmm. developmentally. Mm-hmm. They live in a world where there's lots and lots of reinforcement of peers that are saying, yes, we all need to go and get whatever it is that we think we want or need or should have. What would be the things that parents need to remember? I'll get to things that you think they should do, but let's just leave it for the moment. What should parents remember as that season of teenage development is unfolding?
Well, I think, as you noted, the teenage brain is going to be very self-centered naturally. So we can take heart in that. We need to encourage it to be other-oriented as well.
Right.
And I think allowing experiences that thrust young people into encountering people very different from themselves, taking their perspective, can be very constructive.
Yes.
But to take heart that the brain will synthesize and more connections will be made and the adolescent will be able to move off the self-preoccupation.
Yeah. This is partly why when our boys were teenagers, I used to lay my hands on their head and just say, come frontal cortex, because it felt to me like we needed a whole brain. Whatever else was going to happen, everything will go better when the whole brain is there, which wasn't going to be for another decade. But nevertheless, it felt like it was a reminder that there is actually a physical dimension to this as well as
Absolutely.
A maturing.
There is a biological dimension.
Yeah.
To that point, our church, a father of teenage kids asked for a prayer request that God would save his three kids from knuckledom, because they all seem to be going through knuckledom all differently.
But,
and I thought, yes. And then I thought the thriving perspective is not save us from knuckleheaddom, but save us through it.
Mm-hmm.
Because to thrive is to be a steward of those mistakes and challenges and grow from them.
Mm-hmm. Right. So parents should remember that. Anything else that you think parents should remember as they're trying to just hold on?
Everybody does it differently.
Yes.
Yeah, thriving is really a unique process, which makes the science of it different. So I have three teenagers. So I'm living this and praying that. And they all thrive differently. They have really unique skills and passions and ways of being in this world. And that parenting involves allowing kids the space to find out how they thrive in relationship with their family and their friends. It's mm-hmm. not an individual enterprise, mm-hmm. but that there's a really unique part of that process.
Right. So if you're going to parent individuals rather than a threesome that's not really a threesome exactly, they happen to all live in your family and in your house, but they're actually three very unique people. And yet you are a family in the middle of their uniqueness,
as you
and your husband are additionally. Mm-hmm. Then what are the things that you think help parents to remember the uniqueness, practice mm-hmm. the uniqueness, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. at the same time not lose your mind over trying to figure out how to create a world where everything is tailored to the child, when in fact that's not all that parenting needs to be?
Exactly. This is a great question. If I could know and live the answer, I would make an app and it all would be good. But I think holding the balance again of uniqueness and unity. How do I enable my kids to be their most unique selves, pursue those gifts, passions, shore up their unique weaknesses in a way that balances the cohesiveness and the togetherness of the family? Because I actually am not doing them a favor in the end if I just put all their resources into their individual enterprises and interests. They're learning to capitulate or give up or sacrifice things that they might want to do or think they need to do in order to have the experience of a whole family and have a dinner a week together is ultimately the long run, because it's a lifelong balance mm-hmm. of pursuing our own interests mm-hmm. and the constraints of reality and our needs to give to mm-hmm. others around us.
I'm Mark Labberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. One of the families that stands out the most to me in that regard is a family that I know who are serving together in a mission cause in Asia, and they live in a really exceedingly rough, challenging set of circumstances, I would say. Mm-hmm. When I heard about their children before I ever met them, I thought, oh my gosh, how could children really survive in that circumstance? Mm-hmm. Very, very, very unlike anything mm-hmm. that I would have anticipated. Some of you who are listening to this broadcast might remember David Eubanks. This is the person I'm thinking of mm-hmm. and his family in South Asia and the significance and the risk and the actual physical danger that they are exposed to continuously. Now, what's amazing about them as teenagers now, my experience of them, is their mental well-being. Mm-hmm. So instead mm-hmm. of this, now this wouldn't automatically happen. I'm not trying to make the goal of parenting is that every family should move to South Asia and figure out how to be in a very, very scary circumstance. That's not the goal. I'm just saying it's really interesting that in a context where the reciprocating self, using mm-hmm. your language, mm-hmm. is actually demanded of them mm-hmm. every single day in all kinds of different mm-hmm. ways. Mm-hmm. For some children, I realize that could be traumatic and would not work. I get that. So I'm not mm-hmm. norming that. I'm just saying it's really interesting to me that in that context, they have had to learn for themselves, in their family, in relationship to their neighbors, mm-hmm. in relationship to people mm-hmm. that are the stranger and the foreigner that are in their midst mm-hmm. every day, mm-hmm. they are being formed. So what you're saying about thriving, mm-hmm. I'd say, well, name some teenagers that are thriving. I would, among the teenagers, mm-hmm. I would say, gosh, I mean, this family has some pretty amazing mm-hmm. teenagers. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because of this kind of almost the unexpectedness of it, yeah. right? We feel as though, as parents, we should quote, many parents feel as though we should try to, quote, give our children the best, which means protection away from all of these things, mm-hmm. not engagement. Mm-hmm. Now, clearly there's a reciprocating process that has to be worked out here. But I do find what you're saying really quite challenging to the narrative of what feels like a call for parents to simply serve their children. That's a different vocation
Absolutely.
Than nurturing thriving children.
Absolutely. I think that one of the fundamental engines of a thriving life would be the capacity to adapt. So thriving happens when there's a good fit between the individual and the environment they live. So the Eubanks family
right.
are constantly having to adapt, and they right. don't even have a playbook. And so often what's perceived as excellent parenting is providing and protecting away from the bad things and offering opportunities, but it doesn't necessarily cultivate the capacities and the strengths and the virtues and the character that are needed for an ongoing life of thriving. But when kids face new situations where they have to innovate on the spot, or they have to overcome adversity or get over being upset and emotionally regulate, that's really important. The key thing with thriving, though, it's not just about adapting, because I could adapt awesome and be a great drug dealer, right? But it's the telos. It's the direction towards which we're adapting. So to become more a person who is living and leading and serving out of my skills and passions in a way that's making a meaningful difference to the world around me while I'm becoming more like Christ or more clear about my own morals and ethics, that is thriving.
Right.
And in this day and age, I always like to emphasize the morals and ethics part, because that's not easy to do in this culture, because there aren't clear narratives around what is right and what is wrong, which a lot of people will bemoan that, oh, our culture is in so much trouble. But I think it's a great opportunity for people to be intentional about saying, this is what I base my meaning on, and this is what I think is right and wrong. And so in this way, thriving becomes a dynamic process. Mm-hmm. Like often the word telos in philosophy was a fixed endpoint, like right. the goal. But my understanding of telos is more of a developmental process. Mm-hmm. Like, what do we need as a parent? What do I need to give my kids, encourage the development in them so that they will have an ongoing self-building life in this giving sense?
Right, right. So, and I know that the Thrive Center is not the Thrive Center for youth development. It's the Thrive Center for human development. Mm-hmm. So that long trajectory of thriving continues to unfold over seasons of life in all of their varying ways, which is partly where this capacity for responsiveness to and change needs to continue to occur. So the formative things that you're describing happening in teenage life and children and presumably in teenage life are things that are meant to actually sustain us for the long haul.
Right.
But given that many people have not been formed in that way.
Right.
And you're now a person in your late 20s and you just feel completely non-thriving and lost.
Right.
Or you're in your 30s having succeeded in your first three things, but then having fallen in your next three things.
Right.
What are the signs of hope? What does this trajectory of telos and thriving hold for people that are at some place in their life where they just feel either stuck or lost or confused or whatever it may be?
Well, I think a word that gets a lot of traction these days is purpose. And when I think developmentally about the idea of having a purpose in one's life, and when I think of purpose, I think of something that is actually an achievable goal. Like something, it's not vague, it's something I can go for. And it's something that's meaningful to me, and it's something that actually gives to the common good or the broader good. So it's, in a sense, a noble purpose. And when I think developmentally, I think, you know, a young child doesn't have the cognitive abilities to think about purpose in some existential way, but they have interests and sparks. Like, my daughter loves to make slime. Like, she gets animated. I am sure she will be a creator in whatever she does. It may not be slime, but she will be a creator in some way. And I try and mirror back to her that's a vital spark. And I think over a lifetime, you see those sparks of interest convert into a more intentional purpose that adolescents might actually be after. Like, maybe she'll make a slime business now that she's entering middle school or make money out of making something or do something productive with it. And then I think as we enter adulthood, we start thinking about call or vocation. And so how does that purpose really integrate into our identity, and how, what transcendent beliefs in the Christian tradition, we would say, where is God in this? What is God inviting us into? It becomes, it has a very holy and important meaning. And so I think there's an ongoing discernment process throughout life of, what are the areas that give me the most joy? What are the areas where I feel most alive? What are the things I do, the types of people I'm with, where I'm most activated? And then how can I sustain that activity in a way that has a viable income and in a way that is contributing to the broader purposes of my life?
So what's interesting to me about that, among other things, is that it creates a scenario that allows for correction as life continues to go on,
Absolutely.
As opposed to feeling as though if you didn't get this narrative started in the right way, you can't get to the telos that is the telos of your life.
Absolutely.
Right? So part of the interruption of the gospel in a person's life is meant to be an interruption that awakens, redeems, creates a spaciousness. I love the language of the psalmist that God leads us into a broad place where we can stand and get our bearings, that we're not on a knife edge of hopelessness if we make the wrong choice. That sense of the trajectory that in that way I am called, we are called into continuous thriving, but it will not be it's not a way of saying every day is going to be the greatest day of my life,
no.
but that every day puts me on a trajectory that is about my well-being and the well-being of those around me.
Absolutely. And then that's all viewed through the lens of this broader purpose and picture of whatever is giving you meaning in the Christian narrative, like part of God's kingdom and work on this earth, that we're a part of that.
Right.
So it's not all about me. It is about becoming more and more me, but as I'm bringing life to the world around me.
A me that is made for community.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's that old, well-known African proverb that I am because we are. And that's very different than a Western cultured vision. But it's that sensibility that the gospel carries in it, not just a personal salvation story.
Absolutely. And I really feel that lens, mentality, paradigm is really an important season for the church to promote. That's we have done a lot of me and my relationship with Jesus, and it really needs to be more we and our relationship with Jesus and this planet.
Right. Well, I do think it's an example of one of the failures of evangelicalism, which has been particularly prone toward the for the focus on the individual, and then particularly prone toward a spirituality and theology that really nurtures an individual identity. So when we look at the nature of the church in America, a great deal of what is happening is really the expression of a faith that arms me to keep away the things that might keep me from being all that I want in the world.
Right.
That's the kind of cultivated self-interest that we then bless in the name of Jesus.
Right.
As opposed to a vision of myself that actually puts me always in community, both with my family, with the community of God's people, and with the stranger, the foreigner, the alien, and even, as Jesus says, the enemy. So somehow my, our identity is always seamlessly connected to this larger reality, which is what you're trying to point to.
Absolutely. And the idea of I'm putting up boundaries to protect myself so I can pursue my own rights and interests is ultimately not productive or helpful. And I don't believe what God hoped for us.
And it's not ultimately even our best interest because we end up not becoming who we could otherwise.
Psychologically, we know that fails.
Right.
And I think another thing we know psychologically that fails is just focusing on the positive and strengths. And I think often evangelicalism, because God provides and we can be hopeful and optimistic, we do not embrace the darkness and the difficulties and the vulnerabilities in our lives. And I believe ultimately that is where we thrive, is in our most vulnerable and darkest places. That is where God meets us and transformation happens.
Yeah, I do want to just particularly point any listeners that are remembering or haven't yet listened to either the Conversing episode that focused on the work of Dave Evans and his work on designing your life, which is very much connected, I think, to what you're saying, or to the way that Kate Bowler, who has written her book, Blessed, it was her first book, but then her popular book was Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. And a lot of what she was working on in that was how do we get beyond this sort of positivist vision of everything in which there's no place for disease, health, even death, as a piece of what God is actually, in which God is meeting us, and not just seeing it as the problem per se. It's not only that. It is a problem, but it is it's more than that.
It is. Yeah. I mean, because we believe that God's strength is made perfect in our weakness.
Right.
And if we're blocking ourselves from our weakness, we do not avail ourselves to God's strength and grace and love. That is ultimately transformative.
But we'd so much rather just be strong.
We'd be so much better. I mean, that version of thriving, I would be so all about. This whole having to be authentic and deal with my weaknesses and my poor spelling is just not
not the thing that you necessarily were looking for. If you were to imagine that this work that you're doing in Thriving was really something that caught fire in a way that is emerging in developmental psychology and social psychology, but if you were able to influence it going in a certain direction and you and your own work could really manifest the part of the telos that you're hoping that your work is going to manifest, what would it look like in, let's say, 10 years?
That's a fantastic question. I would love for our common culture, U.S. or globally, to really be captured by this notion of thriving, to have a sense of optimism and hope that there is a way that people can be who they are created to be and become themselves in the constraints of reality. So it's not a perfect picture, but that when we're looking at young people, we would see them not as problems to be solved or quarantined, but as opportunities, cherished, beloved people to be developed. And I would love for people to have an informed sense of how that happens, that having a sense of morality or one's ethics or family's ethics or community's ethics is imperative to that. It's not just about satiating my desires, my wants, but there is really an obligation, or forget obligation, but opportunity to become more yourself in relationship with the broader world. And so that thriving is not just about myself. And so when folks like Kaiser Permanente or others use the word thrive, there's now a new magazine called Thrive on food, that there would be this fuller vision and understanding of people, creation, the world becoming who they are, but that's based on this notion of reciprocity and individualization and also being morally and ethically aware people. And I would really hope that understanding the role of faith and spirituality in that is central.
So I think, obviously, I agree with that concern. And it's interesting because in a certain way, what you're talking about is really an integrated self, right?
Yeah.
That comes about, mm-hmm. using your earlier word, a reciprocating mm-hmm. self. So mm-hmm. so as I, as an individual, engage the world, people, foreigners, mm-hmm. neighbors, mm-hmm. strangers, mm-hmm. things that I like, mm-hmm. things that I don't mm-hmm. like, that mm-hmm. reciprocating mm-hmm. self, mm-hmm. instead of simply trying to carve out my thriving,
right.
I'm actually instead, in fact, trying to nurture the opposite instincts. How do I increasingly include mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in a comprehensive and more holistic way, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. an engagement, mm-hmm. A place, mm-hmm. a relationship, mm-hmm. A capacity of mm-hmm. giving and receiving mm-hmm. in whatever way, mm-hmm. in that larger mm-hmm. reality, rather than the withdrawal into the isolated self that seeks my thriving over and against other people's thriving.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it's the opposite of the Nietzschean paradigm.
Right. Exactly. It's a much more generous, it's not a drawing a line, but it's a giving.
Right.
And that is different than often how we think. And when people are under threat, they tend to withdraw. And there's so many threats culturally right now, ideologically, actual violence, scarcity, that people withdraw. But I think the posture we need to have is engage.
So it's really an Everest climb that you're talking about.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
I mean, it's an extremely difficult thing to imagine. I'm for you in the telos, and I'm sobered by the nature of the challenge because
right.
there are, as you just said, mm-hmm. there's so many things that mm-hmm. push in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I think as Christians, we would want to say, which is precisely why this thriving is ultimately about a work of God's Spirit in our mm-hmm. lives. Mm-hmm. It's not just mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. manufacturing an educational mm-hmm. program mm-hmm. or a psychotherapeutic mm-hmm. vision mm-hmm. or whatever.
Right.
It actually does require not just added to by a spiritual vision, mm-hmm. it actually, from a distinctly Christian point of view, it actually requires God's engagement.
Absolutely. And I think as Christians, we are heartened and empowered by knowing God's Spirit is with us. But I would also say as much as it's a Mount Everest, it's just a daily anthill as well.
Yes.
And I really think at the heart of thriving in this outer life of generosity has to be a transformation of the inner life.
Mm-hmm.
And inner lives are transformed and shaped
yes.
in homes,
yes.
in churches,
yes.
in schools, on sports teams.
Mm-hmm.
And the more there can be a movement around people understanding mm-hmm. The need to enable people to thrive in a mm-hmm. way that is cultivating reciprocity mm-hmm. as opposed to me protectiveness mm-hmm. in my rights, that I think there can be a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read the temperature of culture and hear all the seeking of meaning and mattering, a la popular speakers of Brené Brown,
right.
Lots of mention of the word spirituality, but no real clear definition of mm-hmm. what that means or how that takes shape or how we can even have a dialogue across different mm-hmm. religious or even humanistic convictions.
Right.
But we realize that that's important. I feel like the world is somewhat ready and waiting to think about how to be purposeful mm-hmm. in development and shaping mm-hmm. people.
Well, and because I think going along with what you're saying, I think one part of it is that we also, we see evidences of the hunger.
Yeah.
And
right.
the hunger
right.
is intensified
yeah.
as it is less and less fed by mm-hmm. all of these various mm-hmm. things,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's been human history from the beginning,
sure.
so it's not a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have new forms of it.
Yes,
I have been struck, as I'm sure you have been, especially both of us have lived in the Bay Area, and mm-hmm. one of the really interesting things about the Bay Area is that it, especially because of Silicon Valley, it has this intense sense of mm-hmm. it is the place that everyone comes for whatever it is that mm-hmm. is the je ne sais quoi of the Bay Area, where it's all going to, you know, converge in some cosmic way where I'll have the perfect job in the perfect place with the perfect income and technology that's going to give me the perfect life.
Right.
And if anything is evident from living in the Bay Area, it's that everybody's wandering around trying to find somebody who knows what they're doing and actually can help create and sustain a meaningful, formative life.
Yes.
Despite
right.
nature, economics, technology, beauty,
yes.
community,
yes.
diversity,
right.
I mean, name it,
right.
and it still is in no way present
right.
there.
Right.
And the hungers are everywhere.
They are everywhere.
Yeah. So I think the hope to me in what you're naming here is that we see it everywhere. If we have been, as I think you're saying, in a certain way, we've been created for this kind of vision of thriving. And we are in a moment where there's an intense pursuit of thriving culturally, we might say, in various ways. What you're wanting to make sure is really a critical ingredient that's present in this. This is a unique line of your own scholarship and the work of the Thrive Center is two things, I think, and they're related. One is an acknowledgement and affirmation that this is fundamentally also something which must involve our spiritual life. And secondly, that the telos, which you've been pointing to, is ultimately about something that's much bigger than simply my mere personal goal of what I want to have or be or do. And that bringing those two things together into the conversation of thriving in our culture is really the deep, long work of what the Thrive Center is really about. Am I getting it right?
I absolutely think so. No, I think that's really well said, because there is lots of use of the word thrive, flourishing, well-being, optimal development, but it's always to what ends. And I don't feel like there are people speaking to what ends it should be, especially psychologically. We study conventional, what happens in people's lives. We don't prescribe what should happen. But in this movement of positive psychology, there are finally inclinations of saying, we need to say what people need and what is right. And I think this concept of telos is a very helpful framework and flexible enough that different communities can say, well, this is our notion of understanding how selves we pursue being a self or our sense of connection and contribution and our ethical ideals. So I think that's important. And the capturing the importance of spirituality is essential, because there is, as we talked in the beginning about the emotional aspect of spirituality, that it fuels us in a way that just knowing the right thing to do doesn't do. And when we can rely on something bigger than ourselves, that is very empowering, whether it's a community of people or a transcendent other, whether it's God.
Which then raises, I would call it a sort of classic Christian question, that I can't ultimately thrive myself. I can't make myself thrive. I can add my own ingredients. I need the ingredients of others and the world. And I ultimately also need the ingredient of God's presence throughout all of those dimensions of life, which actually then enables me to and us to move in that richer direction.
And just to comment on that, I think, so my brother and I have a piece coming out in the technology issue of Fuller Magazine. And one of the issues, he put really nice words to it because he does technology, that we have this bizarre sense of connectedness today, with people through platforms, et cetera. But we're lacking is both intimacy and accountability. And so I would say transformative relationships, relationships that enable us to thrive, communities that enable us to thrive, have intimacy where we're known, but there's also accountability. It's very easy for us to be connected without those two right now. But I don't think transformation and the deep formative work that enables one to thrive occurs without that intimacy and accountability.
So your brother, Michael, is somebody who has a really remarkable job working in artificial intelligence. And among the things that I think has been so moving to me in hearing him talk about that has been this incredible sense that he so studiously avoids social media because of the absence of those two things. It's an illusion of intimacy and it's an absence of accountability. And I have been really moved by the evidence of his own practices in saying, I'm just not going to live in those spaces because even though his life is technological professionally and his future is about artificial intelligence and all the things that are related to that, what he's pursuing is actually a human understanding of knowing and of being known. That's the core of his understanding of what the achievement of artificial intelligence is really about, rather than the mechanical manipulation of large amounts of data and machine learning and all of those things. He's really pushing it. And he's pushing it, I think, in this telos that is driven by his own sense of what a human future actually looks like.
It's enabling technology to enable humans to be more human.
So you've talked a lot about telos. I'm just curious, what is the role of the church in telos? How does the church and individual telos or social telos actually interact?
That's one of my favorite thoughts these days. So I think this is one of the places where I love my work, that I get to be in psychology and science, and I also am in theology and ministry. My personal experience of the church, much of my life has been about, and you've heard me say this, focusing on what Jesus' death has saved us from sin and hell. And the thriving orientation would be, what are we being saved for? And the thriving perspective would be, we're being saved for purpose and for contributing to God's ongoing work in this world. So when I hear people, even around Fuller, say, we need a fuller understanding, no pun on words, Fuller, understanding of discipleship, or we need to revisit what discipleship means, I really understand discipleship being about following Jesus, forming people in a way that enables them to become the person that God created them to be so that they can participate and lead and serve in God's ongoing work in this world.
Which then ends up enabling the thriving of others.
Exactly, which enabling the thriving of others. And I think in our current cultural zeitgeist, that issue of how do we help people find purpose that is ethical, connected, has transcendence, belonging, informs identity, I think that will have traction in culture. And when the church wrestles with issues of relevance in this current climate, I really wonder if issues around vocation, purpose, and call and enabling people to do that would be really helpful. And I think also promote this concept of a more communal thriving.
Pam, thank you very, very much for this conversation. This has been a great gift, and I hope that our listeners will maybe listen to this a couple of times, because I think there's some material in this that's really worth giving a great deal of reflection to. Thank you very, very much for being here and for the work that you're doing in the Thrive Center and at Fuller. You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.